Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. Today, we'll be talking to Nicholas Walton about his new book, Singapore, Singapura, From Miracle to Complacency. This is a fascinating travelogue, history, and analysis of Singapore. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Perhaps we could begin by you telling a little bit about your own, about yourself and sort of your intellectual history and how you came about writing this book.
Right, well, I'm English. I'm originally from Newcastle, but lived around the world a bit when I was a kid. So I kind of developed a very wide horizon on the world and got fascinated in how the whole place knits together, as children do. And I hope that that's something that's informed my career all the way through. Fundamentally, I'm a journalist, but that wasn't the original intention. I went to Oxford as an undergraduate, and I studied politics, philosophy, and economics. And I got especially interested in the situation in both Latin America and in Africa. And my intention was always to take a very short break, learn a bit of Spanish, and go back and do a postgrad, and see where that took me. Hopefully, to one of those lovely studies with a tweed jacket and books all over the place where I could spend my time teaching people and learning more things about what I wanted to learn. But unfortunately for me, I obviously had a bad sense of direction, because instead of learning Spanish and going to Latin America for a year or two, I ended up in Hungary. And it wasn't too long after the wall came down. So it was a fascinating time to be out there. I ended up with a Hungarian girlfriend who drove a Trabant car, and I had a big typewriter, and I ended up writing things for a local radio station. And my perspective on life changed a little bit, and I thought, my goodness me, this is even better than the wood-paneled Oxford sort of don life. And so eventually I thought, okay, I'm going to learn to be a journalist. And I went back to Britain, eventually ended up being a trainee at the BBC. And I stayed in the BBC for 14 years, and I was very lucky. I mean, every generation of journalists refers to the previous one as a bit of a golden generation. But at the time, you know, world news was taken very seriously. I spent most of those 14 years in the BBC World Service, mostly doing radio, a bit of TV, and a few other bits and pieces. I did all manner of jobs. I worked through some of the biggest stories of the post Cold War years. For instance, 9/11. I was working on that quite intensively. Kosovo War. Lots of other bits and pieces. I was correspondent in Sarajevo, in Warsaw. I worked in Moscow during the Second Iraq War, and I reported and made documentaries all over the place, places like Sierra Leone and Georgia, and so on. So I had a varied life, a very rich life as a journalist. But I'm one of those people who also doesn't fit too neatly within many institutions. So after many years of kind of arm wrestling managers and wondering what I was going to do and so on, I left and worked for a foreign policy think tank. It was a bit of a startup called the European Council on Foreign Relations. And I stayed there for 4 years in London. It was good fun, quite baffling. And it was during the Euro crisis, the financial crisis. So it was a very interesting time to be working on that. And then the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings happened during those years as well. So that was all very interesting. But again, maybe because I'm a bit footloose, I left after 4 years. This time it was after the birth of my son, and we moved, my wife and I moved to Genoa with my son. My wife's from Genoa, so it was part of her maternity leave, and it was good fun. And I decided this was the time to write a book about a tiny country that rose from unpromising beginnings to become a critical node in the emerging economy of the time and reinventing itself and then eventually finding out that it ran out of runway. So I had a lot of fun there, but then we moved to Singapore, and I was there for 3.5 years. Originally, I was what was known as a trailing spouse, so I didn't have a formal job. And I did lots of work there for all sorts of people, sports TV work. I even did a bit of international studies lecturing, but I also worked for the Economist Intelligence Unit, writing reports for them. But at that point, I thought, it's time to write another book about a tiny country that rose from unpromising beginnings to become a critical node in the emerging economy of the time, reinventing itself, and then see whether those questions suggested that this place would run out of runway itself. And that book was, of course, about Singapore. So that's how I that's kind of where I ended up doing that. In terms of, as you say, a bit of back, academic hinterland. I've been very interested in these questions of when things end. Obviously you've got things like the Roman Empire, how that started to fall apart. I'm at this minute, one of the books I'm reading is the Luttwak book on the grand strategy of the Byzantine Empire. And these things, that sometimes they last for just a handful of years. Sometimes it's generations. Sometimes it's hundreds of years. But of course, all things come to an end, and it's trying to work out how you can actually spot these things in advance. My current job is actually with the environmental think tank, the World Resources Institute, and of course, the questions of societal apocalypse and collapse are all around us when we start talking about the environment. So these issues are still part of kind of what keeps me academically curious. And those are the things that I threw at the book about Singapore.
Your description of Genoa and of Singapore, just very briefly, of course, is almost identical. Yet you subtitled your book From Miracle to Complacency. Perhaps you could expand a little bit on why.
Well, either way you look at Singapore, if you really sort of look at some of the metrics of success and so on, whether you're dealing with the 200 years since Sir Stamford Raffles stepped ashore in literally 200 years from this year in 1819, or the time since the reluctant independence of the place in 1965, either way you cut it, you're looking at a remarkable story of success. One of the people I interviewed, the eminent former diplomat Kishore Mahbubani, he said that he was making the outrageous claim that it's the most successful country since records began. It's off the charts. If you look at it back in 1965, I mean, it certainly wasn't just a question of mud flats with a few British administrators. But it wasn't a remarkable place in terms of its success in you know, anything from GDP terms to, you know, education, social indicators or whatever. And it was a tiny place. And yet, if you look at it now, the last time the PISA tests, the OECD tests on educational attainment were run, Singapore was top out of all countries in the world in all three. Its GDP per capita is quite extraordinary, especially when you remember that this is a place without natural resources. It's not Qatar or Norway or somewhere like that. This is a place that didn't have much to begin with in terms of natural resources. And then if you look at all sorts of other indicators, whether, you know, the crime is a fantastic one. These things suggest that this is a country that really is truly and utterly, as Mahbubani says, off the charts. So a miracle has taken place in some way. And when I arrived there, as I said, I had no formal job. So I spent a lot of time walking around the island with my one-year-old son in a pram, looking at things, examining things, meeting interesting people and always asking questions, as a good journalist. And, started to piece together what was my interpretation of what had made the country tick. What was it that was the recipe, the secret sauce that had created quite a remarkable place? And the more I looked at it and the more I thought about it, the more questions came into my mind about, okay, so if this is what's worked so far, will it work in the future? What's being done? Is this being recognized? And so on. And there were also other currents coming into my mind, and that was the sense that what happens to a lot of places that are successful or even mildly successful for a while, one of the biggest things that comes in is not, a barbarian invasion or a tsunami wave that wipes it from the earth. A lot of the time, it's a kind of a gradual, sometimes just complacency, sheer complacency. It's a failure to adapt. A place can even have a leadership that keeps trying not to be complacent and keeps trying to reinvent the place and, plot a course through stormy seas. And sometimes the people become complacent because they become used to the success that they've had. There's no fire at their feet anymore. And this is certainly something that I began to recognize. I'm certainly not the only one. I mean, this is quite a well-recognized phenomenon in many circles in Singapore. And I started to recognize this and try and sort of piece together a bit of an argument. I'm not a social scientist. I'm not a historian. The academic life, as I said, was something that, despite going back to university to do a master's sort of when I was in my 30s, the academic life is not something that I've really plunged myself into. I'm a journalist, so I wanted to tell the story of the place, but also put down this bed of what the secret sauce, the recipe was that turned this country into something quite so remarkable, and then just ask these fundamental questions about its future. So I hope that's what the book's done.
In a sense, one of the key concepts that Singaporeans and certainly Singaporean government officials will put forward is the concept of relevance, that their success is at least in part grounded in the fact that they are relevant to their neighbors and relevant to the international community. And so the question that you're really asking is whether Singapore can retain its relevance.
Yes. But relevance changes. Again, sorry to return to Genoa, but for instance, with Genoa, it helped to knit together the early medieval economy. It, like Venice, and they were big rivals, but they also shared the work in connecting the Europe that was starting to discover itself after what are broadly known as the Dark Ages. And especially the big industrial centres that were starting to grow up in places like northern Italy and Germany and so on and Flanders. They were knitting those together with the trade routes that linked it to the Silk Roads and the places in the hidden away past the Black Sea on the great Eurasian continent. And then the world kept evolving. Large polities like France and Habsburg Spain started to emerge, and then the Genoese, there was a bit of reinvention. They plugged themselves into the Habsburg cross-Atlantic trade, bringing silver back from the mines of Potosí and other places in Latin America, and you know. Basically forming financial instruments that then allowed the Habsburg to fight wars in the Low Countries. So they kept reinventing themselves, and they had to because the circumstances change. And then, of course, the Spanish, ended up pretty much bankrupt, and then they kept running out of road. And that's the Genoese story. Now, in a nutshell and a bit bastardized, but the thing with Singapore is it worked very well, kind of as an imperial node for Britain. It had the China trade. Things like opium became very important. It had a certain eminence as the kind of lodestar of the East in terms of imperial protection in the years leading up to the Second World War. And then if you look at the post 1965 years with the PAP and Lee Kuan Yew, they, you know, with the help of the Dutch economist Albert Winsemius, who helped to reconstruct Rotterdam in the years after the Second World War, they came up with a plan to really leverage the, as you say, the relevance of Singapore, its geographical inheritance, and work out, well, what can we do to make the most of this? And you know, it was in some ways, you can look at a map and say it's fairly obvious, but actually being able to knit together the plan and the sense of purpose and galvanize a population to do this is not easy. And that original kind of geographic inheritance was also very difficult. It was not a friendly neighborhood that the independent Singapore was born into. But then they reinvented themselves as circumstances changed. Countries move up the value chain. This is what China's doing now, you know, and there are very large questions about what China does with its economy and how to repurpose the economy. What do you do with internal demand? Are you still the kind of workshop of the world as China has been for the last 20 years or so? Probably more. The Singaporean government was very effective. I mean, it wasn't without its problems. And sometimes it's only when something goes wrong that you're able to recalibrate and rethink and start again. And the original emphasis on industry and so on then developed into an emphasis on developing Singapore as a petrochemical hub, which is still very important. It took advantage of the fact that the Middle East oil from the Middle East became post-war so critical to the world economy. And at the same time, you had the Vietnam War, then you had Japan rising, you had Korea rising, you had China rising, the East Asian tigers. You had a very benign situation, but where the different factors were changing, and Singapore was able to adapt. It, for instance, in the late 90s, it switched its educational system around. There were a couple of economic setbacks, and it worked out what to do. It became a financial hub. And what I find ingenious about Singapore is that its relevance to the area was also enhanced by a real technocratic recognition of detail. For instance, if you look at a couple of the more striking things, you had back in 1988, you had a really bad crime problem. You had 50,000 crimes, almost 50,000 crimes. And in 2016, after a very concerted and deliberate attempt to tackle the crime problem, to make the place more suitable as a kind of hub for multinationals who really wanted to service Southeast Asia and East Asia more generally, by 2016, that 50,000 crimes a year had fallen so dramatically that there are 135 days in the year that had no reported crime whatsoever. You had the chewing gum ban, that kind of emblematic chewing gum ban, which a lot of people remember Singapore for. That was only brought in 1992, and that was part of this concerted effort to just wipe out everything. It was zero tolerance. It was, you know, people were putting chewing gum on the sensors that closed the doors of the MRT, Mass Rapid Transit system. And there was just this decision, right, well, let's get rid of chewing gum. And that was the kind of technocratic, quite controlling government decision that Singapore became good at. And my favorite of all of these was after the SARS epidemic in the early 2000s. Again, the situation was changing. East Asia, Southeast Asia had a bit of a bad international reputation, which of course was very bad if you were setting yourself up as a place for rich, highly skilled, highly mobile expats from around the world to come to service the multinationals. They decided in 2002 that one of the keys to unlocking this, especially after the bad press of the SARS epidemic, was to invigorate the nightlife economy. And part of that was they decided, and this was even sanctioned by the Prime Minister in a National Day speech, they decided that they were going to have dancing on tables in bars, and they set up a committee that was able to go around the world investigating exactly how people danced on tables in bars around the world, how it could be done safely, what were the risks. You know, they probably drew up lots of very clever charts about, you know, the possibilities, the opportunities, the risks, etc. And then they came back and they drew up guidelines. And this was, again, a perfect example of how Singapore's relevance isn't just something that that sits on a map. It's something that's very alive and very, very attuned to the changing situation. And that's the genius of Singapore. It's not just the fact that it's geographically got a fantastic inheritance. It's the leveraging of that inheritance, which has been a key part of the miracle.
Indeed. Sticking with Genoa for a second, if you compare the history of Genoa and the development of Singapore, and particularly look at the decline of Genoa, are there things that Singapore can learn or has not learned from that experience?
I suppose that actually this is something that I spoke about with Kishore Mabubani when I was visiting him. And we were talking about Genoa after the interview and after I turned the microphone off. And I was comparing the two. And he was saying, well, Genoa declined for 500 years. If Singapore ends up declining for 500 years, maybe that's not too bad a thing. You know, how long does a country last for anyway? So I think that there's an element where you have to almost accept a bit of fate. You're not going to be the world's most vigorous country, you know, a small country forever. And when you're a small country, there comes a point where maybe you have to accept that certain things are changing. And there might be a reinvention again in the future. For instance, to take the Genoese case, after that initial flourishing in, you know, 1100, 1200 and so on, there was a period of decline as bigger states started forming around. And, you know, Genoa just couldn't keep track of that. Venice did for a lot longer. And then that reflourishing, you know, as the bankers for the Habsburg Spanish, that was a lot later on. And that was under the galvanizing influence of a very remarkable man called Admiral Doria. So these things aren't linear. Now, where Singapore is now, it does actually face...
No, go ahead. I interrupted you. Sorry.
Okay. Just a very, very small point. And that is that, yes, the circumstances have changed, but the situation has remained benign for a good amount of time. You know, the international order has been stable, even if the Cold War was rumbling on and so on. There's been peace. Trade has flourished. East Asia has risen. Northeast Asia has risen. The international order has been maintained, etc. And, you know, the people have still needed to ship petrol and oil and gas from the Middle East through to East Asia and beyond. Now, those things are the things, those kind of macro factors. Now, if they start to change, maybe Singapore will face a period of decline if it can't cope. And if it can't reinvent, maybe it finds a way to kind of sit out a few decades and then reinvent itself and come back fighting as Genoa did under Admiral Doria.
As I was reading your book, I thought there was not only a comparison to Genoa, but also a comparison to Israel on various levels. You speak in the book about the brain import and the fact that key Singaporean institutions were created by minorities like the Armenians, the Jews, Yemenis. Israel, of course, benefited enormously from a brain import. You also hinted sort of at it, you know, when you said that later generations get used to the wealth and the standards of living, and that you get a sense of emerging entitlement, if you wish, but also a loss of sense of pioneering, which is could be said about Israel. Also, and finally, in terms of security perspective, it strikes me that Singapore and Israel have sort of very similar outlooks. They worry continuously and they worry about their neighbors. In Singapore's case, of course, Malaysia, partly determined by common history, and Indonesia by size and the fact that it is the world's largest Muslim country.
I think that that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the themes in my book and the structure of the book is built around that initial kind of 53-kilometer walk that I did in one day across the country. And as well as allowing me to structure the book and as well as providing a bit of a narrative arc that always helps, it was deliberate. It was there to show that single unalterable fact that Singapore is a very small place. It doesn't have strategic depth, just like Israel, and just like several other very vital little states that have risen in the past. But the Israel case is very interesting because, of course, it's a way of interpreting its politics and its foreign policy, obviously, with the United States. It's a way of kind of achieving both a sense of vitality, but also achieving a kind of an artificial sense of that strategic depth. A country like Russia or Italy, it can afford to, you know, lose the plot a little bit, really kind of not get anywhere for decades, for generations. And it'll still be there, you know, provided that the international situation is relatively benign and things don't completely and utterly collapse. There will be a Russia or there will be an Italy, no matter what happens to GDP. Now, Israel and Singapore, you're right. There is this sense that if they don't renew themselves, if they don't find a new way to be able to deal with just the sheer tiny size that they have, this lack of strategic depth, this lack of this lack of the comfort blanket of being large, then they are doomed. It's not just a sort of comfortable retirement, but they have to keep peddling and keep that fresh blood coming in, that sense of vulnerability, that sense of purpose. Again, there's the thought that the sense of purpose might be the big thing that's missing in Singapore. What is it in the future? I mean, the government can bring in new bits of the economy, like the way it's tried to invigorate the knowledge economy. It has this area called One North. It has some increasingly world-class universities. It has this financial sector where it has a real strong emphasis on seeing what can be done in fintech and so on. And that's all very interesting. But does that actually filter through to the population? Is there a sense of inequality, and the inequality, does that breed anger, resentment? How does it deal with that for a fairly technocratic, relatively authoritarian democracy? Does that mean that the government runs out of legitimacy in these days of social media, where people are able to express their discontent? There's a bit more identity politics around. What does that mean for a very multi-ethnic, multi-religious political unit? How does it cope with all of those challenges and pressures? And these are very real. And small countries fascinate me because they get these questions right, or they really just face oblivion in the long run.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There's another aspect of Singapore and Singaporean history that you describe, that also in a different way is true for Israel. And that is that the lack of a sense of victimhood. So Singaporeans have less of an attitude towards their colonial history as having been victims, and more a sense of continuity and values and interests that drove Stamford Raffles when he landed on the island in 1819.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But it is quite a complex issue. I mean, you're there now, and you'll have seen that when you had the 200th anniversary back in January of Raffles turning up there, there was this sense that we need to connect it to the deeper history of Singapore as a part of the Malay world, Southeast Asia, etc. And there is also this narrative that some people detect very strongly in what the People's Action Party, which has been in control, obviously, of independent Singapore since its establishment, that the miracle is all due to the PAP and the wisdom and drive of Lee Kuan Yew and his genius. And, you know, there is an element of that that's correct. But I think most sensible people say, well, post-65 Singapore is very different from what was there before because it was a colonial outpost. But at the same time, the type of vision that Stamford Raffles had, the way that Singapore developed under the East India Company and then the British Empire, was something that gave it quite a remarkable inheritance by 1965. This kind of set of very good institutions, very durable institutions, the rule of law, the idea that trade and flexibility and dynamism could be at the heart of really leveraging what we've been talking about, this relevance not just to the region but to global patterns of trade. That is something that that defines Singapore now. As for the sense of victimhood, I think that I detected a bit of victimhood developing, and maybe it's because there aren't those, you know, much more kind of real is not necessarily the word, much more visceral sense of deep vulnerability. You know, in 1965, lots of things could have gone wrong that could have ended the country as a viable place. Now that's not going to happen, but there is a bit of resentment building up. I spoke about this in my book. For instance, during the walk, I passed somewhere. A bit of context first. About 85% of people in Singapore live in what are called Housing Development Board buildings. They're all built by the government. Fundamentally, they're owned by the government, but they're leased. So people buy the lease, usually 99-year lease from the government. And this is 85% of the population have that. Now, going back at least 10 years, probably a bit more, there was something built called the Pinnacle at Duxton, and I walked past it on my walk across the island. And this was meant to be an aspirational HDB. It was right on the edge of the very, very centre of town. It had spectacular views south across across to the islands of Indonesia and north across the whole of the island of Singapore. It was very swanky. It had rooftop running tracks. It was 50 floors high. It had it was several towers all joined together by these special sky links. It was quite a remarkable building. And a friend of mine has a flat in there, so I've been in there a couple of times. Now, this was developed because there was this sense that the Singaporeans were getting resentful that there was a glass ceiling that they kept bumping their heads above. It's fine owning being one of the 85% who owns a flat in an HDB, but how do you make the leap from that to one of the increasingly vastly expensive private condominiums or even houses and villas across the island? Most people can never do that. The costs are just astronomical. So most people feel as though they're shut out of this very swanky lifestyle. They look at aspirations like owning a car. Now, owning a car in Singapore is not an easy thing. It's strictly controlled by the government to prevent the place just being an endless morass of traffic jams like Jakarta or Bangkok. And that's worked very well, but it means that most people are priced out of owning a car. And what about the jobs? Well, people look around and they see a lot of the jobs are still expats from abroad, people like my wife, I suppose, and many of the friends I had there, they were foreigners. We knew some Singaporeans in these senior jobs, but a lot of them were simply imported into the country, you know, with the multinationals. And a lot of the kind of junior and middle ranks are where the Singaporeans sat, wondering if they would ever break through the glass ceiling to become, you know, one of the people that ran the companies. And of course, a lot of the best performing Singaporeans academically are siphoned off into the increasingly into the ever effective public service. So, you know, you don't see many Singaporeans running the companies, or at least as many as you would imagine that there would be there. And then you have rich foreigners like people from China and Indonesia who've made millions and millions and millions buying up entire tower blocks of new condominiums, often not even living there, and every so often turning up to race their Ferraris in the streets, often with catastrophic consequences. And a lot of Singaporeans, as a result, they are developing a sense of resentment. So there isn't that sense that they have enemies in the world around them. But there's a sense that there is actually something going wrong, and they can put a vague idea onto that. And that, I think, is the answer to where to your question and where that's going now.
You touched on a number of issues that I wanted to raise with you. One is, no doubt there's a glass ceiling, and no doubt there is some degree of resentment. But it strikes several things strike me. One is that if Singapore has a trauma, it's not colonial history or persecution. It's what you mentioned, 1965, race riots. And so one of the key issues and real sensitivities in the country is intercommunal relations. And you see contradictions there, and you describe that also, where you have racial profiling in rental ads. Yet what is said about communities and intercommunal relations is, in a sense, very strictly controlled. The other question that I have, and that goes also into the housing issue, is that it strikes me that at the end of the day, you'll hear a lot of grumbling from Singaporeans, but they all have a stake in society, and it's a kind of stake which would persuade them not to rock the boat. You know, they may want to see more opposition in parliament. They may want to see greater transparency on certain things, but they're not. They've got too much to lose.
Yeah, I think that you're dead right there. But you know, boats can be rocked, not necessarily from a single kind of everyone swelling to running to one side of the boat and the whole thing capsizing. They can just sort of gradually get in rockier seas and you know, more difficult to control. And those little tremors of one person shuffling around on their seat in rockier seas can upset the whole thing. I mean, I think I'm torturing the metaphor a little bit there, but fundamentally, I think that this is something that terrifies the government and has terrified the government all the way through. I mean, there is this, you wouldn't say the specter of communal violence, but communal friction is something that I think people often point to. And I know it's a bit of an overused trope by many journalists, and I'm as guilty as anybody. But talking to taxi drivers can be very revealing about this. And taxi drivers, I think increasingly they you know, that you do find people, you know, whether it's a Malaysian chap or a Chinese chap or an Indian chap from these different the three main ethnicities, you do find them quite freely bad mouthing people. And this sense that there is just an undercurrent of people just saying things that they might not have said in the past. This becomes extremely difficult in 2019, where social media has plays a role. It magnifies things. It means that the kind of muttered thing under somebody's breath suddenly is put out into the open air. You know, whenever there's a big scandal and someone sends a death threat to someone else and the police investigate, that's what happens here in Britain. And actually, it's the type of idiot who might have said, "Well, I hope you die," or whatever to a politician and wrote something down and mutters it to his friends in the pub. Now he puts it on Twitter. And of course, it's taken seriously by the police, whereas quite frankly, it's just nonsense. Well, the same kind of dynamic could be at work in Singapore. You know, the type of person who might, you know, mutter something under his breath about, you know, the people down the hall whose cooking smells, they might now put it on social media. And then it becomes an issue in a way that it wasn't in the world that I grew up in, and the world before social media became such an influence. So I think that that's a bit of a danger. And that also means that you end up going from, you know, keeping this straight is a bit of a game of chess anyway for the government, but then you end up with a kind of multi-dimensional game of chess that the government's got to play to be able to keep all of these things, all of the pressures and all of the just everyday bits of friction that are part of normal life. They have to stop it blowing up. One thing that I mentioned in the book is where 2017, I think it was, there was going to be the election of the next president. And it was decided that it was a very, very good idea, perhaps with a nod to the pressures that we're talking about, if that president was from a different ethnic community. The three ethnic communities, so the idea went, should you know, if they hadn't had the presidency for a while, then they should get the presidency this time. Now, there had been a South Asian origin person in the presidency. There'd been Chinese people in the presidency. So under this new idea, the idea was, okay, well, this time we're going to have a Malay person in the presidency. And there was a bit of scouting around to find the best candidate. And there was a really good candidate called Halima Yacob. She was put forward, and there was a lot of grumbling on social media, including from the Malay community, saying, well, why do we need special treatment? This is, you know, and it became a bit of an issue. But then, you know, there was this sense that the government couldn't stop itself from trying to rig the game a little bit further in its favor. And eventually, the original potential cast of candidates was completely and utterly cut down by changes in the electoral law, saying that instead of just being either a senior political figure or having run a public company of X million pounds or dollars or whatever, the figure suddenly became enormously large. And suddenly the last person who might have been standing against Ms. Yacob was pulled out, had to pull out of the race because suddenly they didn't fit the criteria. So suddenly, from the point of having this really good Malay female candidate who would have done a really good job in a country where most people, as you say, still implicitly think that you know, there is this tacit acceptance that the PAP is running things still very well. And she would probably have won the election quite comfortably. But rather than risk it, the government overmanaged. It was almost too keen not to be complacent. And it overmanaged it in a way that made the many people in the Malay community sort of sit up and say, hang on, we feel as though this is almost some kind of handicap scheme that you're running here. I'm using my own probably badly chosen words. But, you know, is it really so bad for the Malay community that we can only win a race when you nobble all of the opposition like this? And it meant that there was a real, what I thought of as a bit of a falling off of legitimacy of the PAP way of running things. And I think that represents the biggest challenge to them in the future, this kind of coming together of social media that allows people to be able to vent their opinions that they might have kept private or, you know, spoken about in their kitchen at home in the past. And this sense that there is still this need for control at the higher level by the government. And pulling all of these levers and trying to play these multi-dimensional games of chess. You know, you're lucky if you string quite a few victories together, but at some point you're going to get something wrong. And, you know, all you need is a bit of identity voting emerging or some kind of knock to the country that causes people to wonder whether, you know, just those people at the margins of voting for the PAP to knock their belief in how everything's going or the belief that the status quo can be upheld and that the, I suppose, any incipient friction between the different communities or religions can be held in check. I think that that represents a very real threat to the country. And while I speak about these, I in no way suggest that I could do a better job. These are easier things to identify than fix.
There is a related risk which you see playing out in Singapore, which is, one, the rise of identity politics globally, and the rise of basically civilizational leaders. And you see that now, you know, if the concern over the last 10 years, 15 years, was particularly the risk of radicalization at the fringe of the Muslim community, you're now also seeing a much more assertive evangelist community.
Yes. Yes, and there was, I can't remember, there was, I touch a bit upon the Christian community when I talk about that church that ran into all sorts of scandals. But yes, there is, there are claims to identity that go beyond the state, and obviously social media can help to organize this. The growth of new voices such as an evangelical community or more extreme versions of Islam, which may be imported from outside. And we know that not just in Singapore, but regionally, there were people who took part in some of the conflicts that have happened in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria. So you know, there are people being influenced by this. You've also got worries that some of the migrant workers, the lower skilled workers, some of the people from Bangladesh, for instance, they've been uncovered apparent extremist communities within a small number of those. So these things are all knocking around. Again, I don't really know what to do about it. One thing I did speak about was, and this feeds it more into identity politics in general rather than the religious divisions, but the Pink Dot Festival, which was this celebration of the gay, the LGBT community, every year in Hong Lim Park in the center of the downtown. I remember going along there. In the first year, my wife had certain friends that were part of it, and it was a very interesting thing to be part of. You know, to go along, you had all of these chaps in pink t-shirts, and Hong Lim Park was a bit of a celebration of this other identity, which you know, on the legal books, was not necessarily as well accepted as it is in certain Western countries. But gradually there's been a bit of a crackdown on that. And the, you know, foreign companies are no longer allowed to sponsor it. There are now laws that if you are foreign, if you're not a Singaporean, you're not allowed to even loiter in that area on Pink Dot Day. These are certainly the rules when I left a couple of years ago. And this was a sense that this was gave people a sense of identity that may be created again. I suppose there was a religion came into it, because there was the sense that certain communities, especially the more religious older people, particularly in the Malay community, the Muslim community, would find this very uncomfortable if it was too visible, but there was this sense that you can deal with identity politics by kind of putting pressure on people, by stopping it, by bringing in rules, by cutting things off at the margin, and that I think is something that Singapore will struggle to do with identity politics in the future. We've seen it affect so many people here in Europe, affect the United States most obviously, but I think that Singapore is not immune. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I have no idea how.
I want to come back to something you said at the beginning of this conversation, where you were talking about education, knowledge economy. One of the things that has always struck me was that Singapore, in contrast, for example, to the Gulf states, the contrast not only being that Singapore did not have resources, which the Gulf states did, but was much more that Singapore, certainly today, is sort of a hybrid between a controlling state and a democracy. But most importantly, Lee Kuan Yew certainly had a vision for the country rather than for the ruling party or the ruling family. And the education system, in a sense, was geared towards empowering people, which, again, the education system in the Gulf certainly isn't. And that was what really why Singapore became a success story. And the Gulf states, in many ways, are not success stories. They're, admired, envied, whatever, for the amount of money and wealth that they have, but not much beyond that.
Yeah, the education system in I wrote a paper for the Economist Intelligence. Actually, I wrote several papers about education for the Economist Intelligence Unit. And Singapore, of course, is a paradigm in some aspects. But as you say, there is an element of control. There's an element of tradition. But it's interesting to see how it all evolved into this kind of seemingly all-conquering system that they have now. The education system seems to me to have always been calibrated towards the national goals. So there was a great emphasis on the kind of technical qualifications needed when heavy industry was the thing, and so on. And now, the very high levels of mathematical excellence in the Singaporean system have been pointed quite squarely at the type of services that Singapore is at this very moment excelling in. It has the financial sector, for instance, is one of the financial sectors of the world. And in terms of its geography, China will continue to struggle in some areas because of the nature of its economy and its political system and its openness to the rest of the world and its currency. And obviously, Hong Kong has got all sorts of questions that it will have to answer after 2019 is over. So, you have this sense that that the economy adapts to deal with its situation. And it is quite empowering in that, people then go and get jobs and the very best of them are hoovered up by the public sector, and you find extremely capable Singaporeans all over the world in all sorts of jobs now. But they once again are at a bit of an inflection point. There is this sense that the knowledge economy needs a different type of education. When I was doing these papers for the EIU, a lot of people were talking about, well, what does education need to be to fit the economy of the mid and late 21st century? And ideas kept popping up about creativity, teamwork, initiative, the ability to fail, the ability to learn from mistakes, etc. And this is where people pointed to the Singaporean system as maybe creaking a bit. And certainly on an anecdotal level, I often spoke to colleagues, mainly expats, but not just expats, who I played football with once a week in Singapore. And many of them were involved in hiring people. And the government kept in bringing in new rules for what you had to do, how many, boxes you had to tick. And the emphasis was definitely on look at Singaporeans first, try and hire Singaporeans first. And it was much more difficult to hire new expats. And many of them were saying, well, ultimately, you don't get the flexibility of mind that we need in senior positions if you go for many products of the Singaporean education system. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure to succeed. There's parents behind the scene who send kids off to the tutorial colleges from very early on in the morning. They go to school. They learn things. They come home. They learn more things. They do homework. And then they go to bed. And there, there's not the rule for the – there's not the space for the – some of the softer skills that are going to be critical in the future, the creativity, the communication skills, the ability to being able to, to use the old cliche, think outside the box. And this is the, these I think are the critical questions for the Singaporean education system. And they're trying to fix it. They are running pilot schemes, or at least they were when I was looking at these situations. They're trying to find ways in which to bring out teamwork rather than, you know, overt competition between people over the highest grades, allow people to find ways to fail and learn from it, and fail and feel comfortable with the fact that, you know, if you set up a new company, you're going to face failure as much as you're going to, you know, it's like that old cliche about Silicon Valley, that you only ever deal with people who've failed once or twice already. Otherwise, they haven't learned enough. And I think that there's this sense that Singapore really needs to replumb its education system, and it's doing it in a typically clever technocratic way. In many ways, you're not unwise if you back them to succeed. But this is a question of mentality of the parents, of the whole system and how it's been set up. So if the Singaporean education system is going to be as effective, and you're dead right in what you were saying in your question, empowering people to succeed in the latest iteration of the Singaporean success story, then this is the big challenge ahead.
You mentioned geography, and perhaps we can briefly return to that. Much of Singapore's success was, of course, leveraging its geography. Yet what we're seeing now is one, that geography is becoming less of a decisive factor in today's world. And it's also becoming a liability to some degree in terms of the great power rivalries that we're having, the reshaping of a new world order.
Yeah, it's a big question. Can that geographical inheritance turn into something a bit sour in a world where technology has obviously shrunk the world? Hydrocarbons being dug up out of the ground in the Middle East no longer need to be shipped quite so far around the world, partly because people are finding other ways in which to power themselves. Obviously, the rise of China and developing into something beyond what it was when Deng Xiaoping pressed the start button all those years ago means that China is a different place. It doesn't need to suck in quite so much. It's developing its own demand, internal demand, so it'll be exporting less in the future. You're developing financial service centers elsewhere. Singapore is a very expensive place. If you're one of those multinationals that flock to Singapore, you know, when we turned up or 10, 15 years ago, do you really need to base people there? Jakarta's obviously sinking, as we saw in the news recently, but Jakarta is now a place where you can live a perfectly good life as an expat. You can go to Bangkok, you can go to lots of places. A lot of companies are looking for places elsewhere in the region, for things that they have to keep in the region. And then they're taking things completely offshore, like the customer relations. Well, if you need that, you can base that in the Philippines instead. You know, a lot of British companies have got call centers in the Philippines and in India because people speak English there. You don't need things like that in Singapore. So more and more things that may have been at the center of leveraging that geographical inheritance, maybe they're just not as, they're not going to be focused on Singapore anymore. It will keep some geographical inheritance. There will always be international trade, but, you know, it'll have shocks, whether through trade wars or wars, or it'll just change in its nature. And there'll also be a need for, you know, because of time zones, something as simple as time zones. London has similar inheritance for its financial sector. Singapore has a very enviable time zone. It picks up when West Coast USA sort of starts falling asleep. And it's a great financial center for that time zone in East and Southeast Asia before it starts getting towards places like Dubai and the sun comes up over Europe. So it's a mixed question. And again, it just goes back to, can they adapt? Can they rethink and recalibrate?
Nicholas, I had many more questions and issues I wanted to raise with you, but unfortunately we're nearing the end of our time. Before I let you go, though, I would like you to talk a little bit about what your next project is and what you're looking at, where you go from here.
Now, It's a difficult thing because in my life, I've discovered that there are three big things, one of which is my family, which I think is the most important by a long way. The next is having a job. And the third bit is being able to work on fantastic projects like writing a book, which is great. Now, in my life, I've discovered that you can only really write a book if you've got two of these. You can only do two of these things, three things all at once, and the world will collapse. So unless something happens, for instance, if I get fired from my job, I can't see myself being able to write a book for a while. I still have a load of ideas stored up in my head. Luckily, I'm working in a very interesting area with all of these societal tipping points about with the World Resources Institute and looking at all these different aspects of the environment. So that is keeping me busy. Living up in the Netherlands, again, to return to that theme that sat through the books on Singapore and Genoa, once again, I found myself living in a very peculiar, relatively small country that really has had a bit of a golden age in the past, back in the sort of 1625 to 1675 time, and then kind of fell out of, historically, it fell out of circulation as a big player. And it waned for many centuries. And then suddenly, the Netherlands of that I find myself living in now, in the lovely little town of Delft, is once again, it's at the center of a lot. It's at the center of Europe and is a very vibrant economy. But also, as the environment changes, it's at the center of a lot of things that the world is going to have to think about a lot in the future. Geographically, its inheritance is in some ways comparable to Bangladesh. But whether through governance, money, know-how, technology, it deals with being at the end of a lot of long rivers with big deltas. Where I'm sitting now is probably about a meter below sea level. Out towards The Hague, you've got these massive sand dunes. You've got just south of me in Rotterdam, you've got these things that the Delta Works projects, which prevent the floods from enveloping the country every time the Rhine and other major rivers come down too quickly and there's too much water coming upstream from the North Sea. And a lot of the country is still below sea level and they've had to adapt. So this country is fascinating. And again, there are questions about, well, this will be fascinating now. What about the Netherlands in 50 years' time? What about if the worst comes to the worst? Will the Netherlands still be above sea level and dealing with these and flourishing in 100 years' time or whatever? So that's what I would like to write. But while I have my family, of course, and then while I am gainfully employed and enjoying having a monthly paycheck, I think I'll just have to put that on ice for now.
Indeed, Nicholas, having read your book on Singapore, it would be a crime if you don't write the book on the Netherlands. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Thank you very much indeed, and thanks very much for the questions.